the sexist station where you'll only hear the female voice.
Radio Gorgeous, where women do the talking.
I'm here with Jane Eastdale, expert on many things, one of which is the Victorian pharmacy.
Uh-huh.
What's in the Victorian pharmacy?
What isn't in the Victorian pharmacy?
That's
the thing. Whatever you needed, whatever you wanted, you could go to them and say, "Ooh, can you please give me some face powder or something to black my whiskers? Or I need to take something to cure tuberculosis." Or
there was everything from cosmetics.
It was soap powder, things to eat, you name it, they'd have a go at it. And a number of the inventions that we use today, matches, soap powder, table salt, bird's custard powder, Bovril, all sorts of things we just completely take for granted, actually came from the fact that these men were out there inventing and creating and determined to give their customers whatever they wanted.
Who were pharmacists? What was the role? How did that role evolve?
Well, it can be quite tricky for people to understand, and indeed for me, I've battled with it for a while in the book, because I think a lot of us have this concept of an apothecary being a chemist.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, they were to a point, but they were also what we would consider today to be a GP. So they would go out and they would see people and they would tell them what was wrong with them. But they couldn't charge them for that. But they would charge them for the medicines they sold. Then you had the physicians, and they were university educated, and they were very clever and generally quite wealthy, because university education cost a small fortune. And then you had the surgeons. And surgeons, often barber surgeons, who had that useful skill of being able to cut hair, remove teeth, bleed people, and perform surgery as and when necessary, which is quite an interesting mix of skills. They had their own function. And at the start of the 19th century, there were 179 physicians in London and 8,000 surgeons.
Wow.
So there were a lot more surgeons because they did a lot more, and you learned that skill through apprenticeship. What happened, the significant change was people used to treat themselves with herbs. There was the sort of the old wives' lore. They had learned skills that were passed down from, you know, mother to daughter. And again, at the start of the 19th century, there was a huge shift in the way everybody lived. The beginning, 4/5 of the population lived in the countryside and only 1/5 in cities. And by the end of the 19th century, that was completely reversed. So it was this huge shift. And when everybody went to cities, they could not make their own herbal remedies. They were not accessible. And they needed to be able to buy something from somewhere. And so these pharmacists, or chemists and druggists, as they were often known, started to emerge, and they would sell you medicines. It should be remembered that the medicines were actually all pretty useless. At the start of the...
Still, it made a good living.
It made a good, very good living. Well, not a very good living, but at the start of the 19th century, people still believed that it was Hippocrates' theories, I should say, that it was the four humours that caused illness, and that it was bad air.
Yeah, so it's blood, bile, mucus.
Yes.
And...
What was the other one?
The other one.
Anyway, and the only way you could treat these humours really was effectively with bloodletting and purging from one end or the other,
right.
Or purging sometimes by blistering your skin. That would be a nice way to help cure a cold or something. You know, you put something on your skin to make your skin blister, and that would be really helpful.
So not only do you have a streaming head cold, but you now have third-degree burns.
Yeah. And that really was all they could do. You know, they would attempt to treat these four humours essentially by making you feel worse. And as a lot of people started to observe, that the cures were often worse than the illness itself. Mm-hmm. And it was in America. There was a gentleman called Thompson who developed a system of herbs called the Thompsonian system, which he brought over to Britain. He sort of sold it on a license. And he just got thoroughly cheesed off with losing members of his family to doctors' treatments.
Wow.
These barbaric treatments. Mm-hmm. And so he started working on selling herbs. And that was how most of these chemists started up, selling herbs. And then they progressed from there.
What person would go to the pharmacist? And how often would you be visiting a pharmacist?
Well, it still cost money. And mm-hmm. most people were very poor. And the real customers of the pharmacist and the chemist and druggist, I mean, the rich and the poor generally would go there. The rich when the problem was not so great. And for the poor, the chemists or the pharmacists were the only people they could go to for help. And there was a lot of work done in the regulation of pharmacy in the Victorian period to try and bring it under control, because initially anybody could, you know, I could go out and sell and start to tell you what would make you better. I might not know anything.
So this is the original sort of snake oil sales.
Absolutely, snake oil stuff. And there was a lot of fighting between physicians and apothecaries and the chemists and the druggists and the pharmacists. Each could have fought each other furiously, and the only thing they were agreed on was they didn't want women involved in it at all. That was the only thing that kind of united them all, was that no women...
Why is that?
Oh, you wanted women to be kept in their place. Actually, of course, a lot of women worked in pharmacies and chemists and druggists compounding the drugs, and they would have been just as capable of men as starting to undertake these exams. And it took a long while for that to progress. But these people did serve a very valuable function. And as the pharmacists became more controlled by legislation, the head of the pharmaceutical society did observe, you know, if a chemist doesn't say anything to his customers, they'll think he's ignorant. So he does have to give advice. And he said for a lot of people who are poor and who quite probably can't read, that's going to be the only advice they get. And in those circumstances, I would say better to get the advice of a chemist than nobody at all.
Follow us on Twitter, radio_gorgeous. Lots of love, darlings. Mwah.
Lots of people are coming with complaints.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of people will be coming with similar complaints.
Mm.
So that the chemist is actually gathering information about what's going on in the health of the population.
Yes.
And that shared information, I guess he becomes part of the collective consciousness of health.
Well, presumably he would see, he would get reports back on what in theory worked, as I say, bearing in mind that they really had until, you know, the first half of the 19th century, there were really no treatments. I mean, there was something called chlorodine, and in that, in a small kind of 1 ounce bottle, there were 12 parts morphine and I can't remember what the percentage was of...
Chloroform.
Chloroform, that's it. It was...
Sounds delicious.
It's a potent... It was a very potent medicine.
Yeah.
I mean, it worked. It didn't do anything for your illness. But, you know, goodness me...
You woke up when it was over.
Yeah, it would knock you out. And, in fact, that is still made today. But, boy, it's only available on prescription. So there were some drugs that could do something. They might not cure you, but mostly they contain terrible poison. They contain mercury and lead and antimony. I even found a recipe for lemonade, actually, which is by the by, that contained asbestos.
Oh my god.
Which,
as something that you should add.
As something you should add to your lemonade. Now, goodness knows whether it gave it a certain zing, I don't know. But they use some extraordinary stuff. Arsenic went into all sorts of preparations.
Mm. Wow. Are things like arsenic, do they have any actual medicinal properties in different doses than would kill you? Or do they, you know, because a lot of things have...
Well,
dual properties.
You can develop a certain resistance. And there was a theory that they used to... I mean, the Victorians, a lot of people were poisoned with arsenic. And you could buy arsenic flypapers, and women would dip the flypapers in water, and they would use the solution and put it on the skins, because arsenic was supposed to be good for your complexion. And men used to take it because it was supposed to help with virility.
Wow.
I know. Who knows? Or who knew? Anyway, what you could do in theory was, this is when, of course, you could buy arsenic over the counter, happily, you could take minute quantities and build up your resistance.
Okay.
And so then if you wanted to poison somebody, you'd gradually build up your resistance.
and you would the same food
put it in the pie, eat the same food, have a little bit more, so you'd be ill, they'd be ill, the person you would kill would be dead, and everybody would think it was an accident.
Ah, was this a common occurrence?
I don't think it was that common, but it was that, you know, the fact that there were huge quantities of poisonings that made the newspapers, both deliberate and accidental, finally meant that there was some legislation put in place to control the sale of such toxic substances. The worst case of poisoning, which I can tell you about if you like, was
the Bradford
poisonings, and one of the factors, I mean, the quality of health in the Victorian era was not what we think. I mean, it was shockingly bad. Everything was wrong. The air quality was bad. The water was appalling. Food was adulterated. People would put in stuff to reduce their costs, essentially. So bakers would put sawdust in their loaves to make them heavier and perhaps use them to plaster Paris as well instead of flour. There was a confectioner who wanted to put in some daft, which was sort of this general term for something you would put in just as a filler that was cheap, and you would buy daft from the chemist, and he sent his assistant off to buy the daft to the chemist, and when he got to the chemist himself was in bed poorly, and he was served by the chemist's assistant, who didn't know where the daft was, so he trotted upstairs to see his poorly employer, and he said, "It's in the cellar in a keg." So the assistant went downstairs, got the keg. He wanted £12 of the daft, took it back, gave it to the confectioner, who made up a great batch of peppermint creams, which looked a little odd and wouldn't dry and weren't quite the same minty green colour as they usually were. So they sold them to a chap called Humbug Billy, who had a market stall. And Humbug Billy took the peppermint creams, put them on his stall, and was taken ill. So somebody else took over his stall for him. And they reckon they sold over 1,000 of the peppermint creams that day. And then during the course of the evening and the night, doctors started reporting that people were sick. The first few cases, they thought perhaps somebody had been poisoned. Then, as it began to spread, they thought perhaps there was an outbreak of cholera, which was a common problem in Victorian Britain. And then the doctors began to put two and two together that everybody who was poorly had eaten the peppermint creams. And they started to go out, the police were sent out with stick-up warning notes, town criers went out with bells to warn people. It was controlled within Bradford quite quickly, but in the villages, the outlying villages where people had gone into Bradford on market day...
And brought the treat back home.
Brought the treat back home, the deaths continued, and in fact about 20 people died and 200 people were taken ill.
Wow.
And most of the people to die were children because they couldn't tolerate... the arsenic.
Wow.
And they tried to take... That's what had happened. The arsenic had been put in by mistake. And they tried to prosecute the confectioner and the chemist, but ultimately it was realised, well, none of them had done it deliberately. It was one of those terrible accidents.
Accidental death.
Yeah.
By poisoning. So in the fact that the chemist... was a person who talked to people about complaints, which is something that continues to this day. If you have questions, ask your pharmacist. Was there an element of placebo healing? Just the very fact of somebody talking to a doctor-like person, someone with more knowledge than you about your illness?
Well, undoubtedly, as in today, there is a placebo effect and...
being heard, being listened to.
Yes, you know, why wouldn't you go there and buy these products that were might do something to help your child? And people were desperate. You weren't popping into your chemist with a little bit of a snuffle or perhaps a sore throat. You were going in with a child who might have diphtheria or tuberculosis, or a man might have syphilis or... heaven knows what, you know, really nasty.
Dire.
You know, these were killers. You know, measles, the contemporary example, you know, measles was not great fun back then. Nobody knew how to treat it. You didn't have the same treatments we do today. There were a lot of things that could carry you off, and they were very happy to be able to go and seek comfort.
And yet that's all that they were getting was comfort and it potentially was. Lethal.
It was.
Lethal cures.
Yes. I mean, towards the end of the Victorian era, they had, you know, finally discovered some medicines that were effective. They had morphine for pain relief.
Right.
They had quinine, which was very helpful. And that, of course, they'd made advances in terms of the understanding of the need for cleanliness. So they were getting into their extreme cleansing
right.
agents.
Hygiene, scouring.
Yeah, beginning.
Right. Mm-hmm.
The beginnings of that.
Wow. And what's the legacy of the Victorian pharmacy today?
Well, the chemists we go into today and we browse in so happily, essentially, you know, that is our legacy.
Yeah, the booths also, you know, it has all of your cleaning stuff, it has all of your cosmetic stuff, it has all of your medicinal stuff.
It has everything. And then, as now, what they allow you to do is to have some control over your own health. We'll all experience the fact that perhaps we can't get a doctor's appointment, we have something wrong with us, we don't know what it is. What we'll do, first of all, mostly, is we'll pop to the chemist and see if we can get something that might help.
Mm-hmm.
And the function was exactly the same in those days. There is one glorious difference, and sometimes children would be sent along to the chemist with notes from their mother and to get something, and one chemist kept a little book of these notes, which you can see in the welcome library. And my favourite note of all, which given today's extensive range of cosmetics is just, you know, fabulous, the note said, "One lipstick, cheapest you got, red."
That works that in
works.
Any era.
Yeah.
Fantastic, I love it. Thank you so much, Jane, for educating us about the Victorian pharmacy.
This has been a Radio Gorgeous production for RadioGorgeous.com. Get in contact with us, contact us on info@RadioGorgeous.com, and to sign up for our shows to come once a week into your inbox. Who can think of anything better, darling?